Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. Simple question, really tricky answer, I think. Can the Fed get it done? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday today, I do believe the 23rd day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Day two it was today of Fed Chair Jay Powell taking questions on Capitol Hill. Technically, his semi-annual monetary policy report to the Congress is what that testimony is called. The general topic you already know, inflation and perhaps recession. The Fed's general cure you already know, too. Raise interest rates, convince everybody you are serious about it, and then hope for that soft-ish landing. One key part of getting there, the soft landing, is to cool down the extremely tight labor market. Those are Powell's words, not mine. A labor market that has had lots and lots of job openings, some really low unemployment and wage growth as well, especially for the least educated and lowest earning workers in this economy. So how is the Fed going to do that without doing damage? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going.
It's pretty much a maxim of labor economics that the least educated and lowest paid workers tend to be hired last and fired first and face the slowest recovery from recession. But things have been really different since the pandemic, says Bernard Baumol at the Economic Outlook Group.
We have seen, really for the first time in modern economic history, people who have been stuck in low-wage jobs, menial jobs, be hired and trained to get better-paying jobs.
Overall, wages are growing at 5.2% a year. But wages for some of the lowest-paid workers in bars and restaurants, truck driving, and warehousing are up well over 11%. There's simply been too much demand for service workers and not enough supply. But this dynamic is fragile, says Heidi Shierholz at the Economic Policy Institute.
Faster than normal wage growth was already starting to moderate. The Fed action will really accelerate that. We will see a lot of slowing of wage growth.
And as job growth slows further and there's less competition for workers,
there's really no sugarcoating this.
Claudia Somm is a former economist at the Federal Reserve.
Using the Fed to get inflation down causes hardship. And we know that anytime there is hardship, it always goes at the people that have the least.
On the Fed's current course, says Bernard Baumol, slowing job and wage growth at the bottom is probably inevitable.
Then, unfortunately, this very positive social change that we've seen in the job market will start to retreat. And that's really a tragedy.
There is one silver lining, though. All of those wage gains racked up over the past 2 years, they're probably here to stay, because employers rarely cut wages once they've raised them. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, not so worried. Traders were, it seems. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, here's one from the Wow, Inflation Really Does Affect Everything file. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau announced this week that it's looking into the fees that credit card companies charge for late payments, specifically whether those late fees are reasonable and proportional to the amount that people owe. They're looking at it now because it turns out credit card companies can change their late fees based on, wait for it, inflation. And given where inflation is now, well, Marketplace's Justin Ho spells it out.
The current rules governing credit card late fees date back to 2009 in the wake of the financial crisis. Back then, Congress was looking for ways to protect people from getting too deep into debt, says Karen Petru at Federal Financial Analytics.
Credit cards became an area where consumer advocates were really focused.
In 2010, the Federal Reserve put a $25 limit on late fees, but it also allowed credit card companies to adjust those fees annually based on the Consumer Price Index. Petru says the thinking was that credit card companies should be able to account for inflation.
And if we fail to reflect it as a cost of doing business, then banks will not do that business. And if banks don't do that business, consumers don't get credit cards.
In the time since, that late fee limit has risen to $30. Thing is, inflation wasn't all that high until recently.
But when you have inflation running at 8 or 9%, then the calculus starts to look different.
That's law professor Adam Levitin at Georgetown. Now that inflation has spiked, he says,
there's a concern that there may be opportunistic behavior by card issuers, that card issuers see a chance to raise late fees because of inflation rather than because actual increased risk to them from late payments.
To be clear, the CFPB hasn't seen any credit card companies do this yet. But CFPB senior advisor Brian Shearer says late fees are already too high, regardless of inflation.
Our research shows that banks are charging $12 billion in late fees alone. That is 10% of the total cost of credit cards to consumers.
The Consumer Bankers Association says many credit card companies waived late fees throughout the pandemic. But Shearer says if the CFPB does nothing, those fees could exceed pre-pandemic levels.
That's why we're taking another look at the rules to make sure that late fees on credit cards are actually reasonable and proportional.
Shearer says that could potentially mean writing new rules that would effectively lower the late fees charged by banks. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Bitcoin's been holding relatively steady this week, just a touch above $20,000, which, depending on when you bought in, is either terrible or not so bad. But crypto, broadly speaking, has been having a rough time. Yes, in pricing terms, obviously. Also, though, in general, is it really worth it terms? The economic term of art is externalities, the costs that crypto imposes on all of us, even if we're not buying it. And Exhibit A today is a bill in New York State waiting for the governor's signature that would be the country's first statewide moratorium on repurposing fossil fuel-burning power plants into crypto mining operations. Walls of computers that those miners use to earn Bitcoin and all the rest of it. Marketplace's Lily Jamali reports now from Western New York.
It's late morning in Penn Yan, New York, a town on Seneca Lake, the largest of the state's majestic Finger Lakes.
I'm just going to grab these life jackets.
Resident Kim Holtzman has invited me on a kayak ride. We started her place on the lakeshore and paddled north. Seneca Lake has been part of Holtzman's life since she started coming to camp here as a child.
It just means the world to me, the Finger Lakes. It's where I met my husband. Many of my friends are from here.
Holtzman and her husband moved here full-time about 2 years ago.
It's beautiful, and Greenwich has changed that for us.
Greenwich is Greenwich Generation, the lakeside power plant in nearby Dresden that Holtzman and I are heading towards, a half-hour paddle from her house. Just ahead of us, there's a giant metal tube that juts out over part of the lake from shore.
We're going to go under. Let's see how we do.
Oh, boy. Yeah, we are going to have to duck a little bit.
The plant depends on this tube to take in water from the lake. It uses it to cool its equipment, and then the water is discharged back in, warmer than before. Holtzman and neighbors worry that harms the wildlife here. They also don't like the noise.
at night, when it's quiet, you can hear a low rumbling all the time.
For decades, this facility burned coal to generate electricity until it was shut down in 2011 for good, neighbors thought. 3 years later, an out-of-state private equity firm bought the plant and converted it to burn a different fossil fuel, natural gas. Today, much of that energy is being used to mine crypto.
All of a sudden, it became Bitcoin.
A spokesperson for the Greenwich plant says it's a model for meeting strict environmental standards while creating new jobs. William Talton holds one of those jobs. He commutes from an hour away in Rochester, New York, to work as the plant's data center crypto lead.
The opportunity that it gave me and my family was amazing, not only financially, but just the opportunity to experience, you know, what is looking like the future with the cryptocurrency and things like that.
But opponents argue the plant's air and thermal pollution is harming the region's agritourism industry, which draws millions of visitors and billions of dollars each year. The bill New York lawmakers just passed would enact a 2-year moratorium to block crypto miners from repurposing plants like Greenwich, although existing facilities could keep operating. Assemblymember Anna Kellis sponsored the bill.
It basically is saying, hands off our fossil fuel-based power plants that are retired in New York State.
Kellis says the crypto industry's intense energy use will make it harder for New York State to meet its stated plan of getting to net zero by 2050.
It is literally going to send us in the wrong direction from our climate goals, which is to get off of fossil fuels.
Crypto industry groups warn restrictions like the moratorium could drive crypto investors and jobs away from New York. John Olson is with one such group called the Blockchain Association.
New York would be the only state with a moratorium on the books. And I think that sends a very, you know, negative signal to an industry that is basically being welcomed elsewhere.
As she deliberates, Governor Kathy Hochul has been criticized for taking money from the crypto industry. Abby Buddington is a Seneca Lake resident organizing against Greenwich.
It's time for her to stand with New Yorkers and not with the crypto billionaires that are helping to fund her campaign and her lieutenant governor's campaign.
Hochul's office said in a statement that political donations have no influence on government decisions. She has until December to make a decision. In Penn Yan, New York, I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Makes no sense whatsoever economically.
Well, that can't be good. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials, 194 points to the good, 0.6%, 30,677. The NASDAQ up 179 points, 1.6%, finished at 11,232. S&P 500 tacked on 35 points, about 0.9%, 37.95. Gunmakers advanced after the Supreme Court struck down New York State's laws on concealed weapons permits. Smith & Wesson up 9.6%, Sturm Ruger up 3.5%. United Airlines down about 2.5% today. The carrier is eliminating 12% of its flights from Newark to reduce flight delays. That amounts to about 50 flights, all of them domestic. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down 3.09%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are in the middle of an historic drought out here in the American West. It's been 3-something years in the immediate term. It's the worst in something like 1,200 years in the very long term. And the Colorado River is a key, maybe the key part of it, both as an economic resource. A study out of Arizona State says that Colorado supports $1.4 trillion in economic activity every year, 16 million jobs. But also as a natural resource, reservoirs out here are at dangerous new lows, and the Federal Bureau of Reclamation has asked the 7 states that rely on the river to cut their water use by a lot. They've got 60 days to come up with a plan, those states do, and if they don't, the feds are going to step in and take care of it. Marketplace's Savannah Marr has this look at the Colorado and the economy.
Seven states and more than a dozen tribal nations rely on the Colorado River for municipal water supplies and to irrigate their crops. Speaking before a recent Senate committee, Camille Tootin with the Bureau of Reclamation issued a warning. Find a way to use less, close to a quarter less, or the feds will do it for you.
It is in our authorities to act unilaterally to protect the system, and we will protect the system.
I heard that as a threat.
That's John Ensminger. As head of the Southern Nevada Water Authority, he's one of the water managers tasked with brokering this emergency conservation deal, and he says it's not going to be easy.
Well, I think every sector, every water user needs to share in the pain.
From corporate and municipal use to the region's biggest water suck, farming and ranching.
There's just no way to do this without agriculture using a lot less water.
John Fleck is a water policy researcher at the University of New Mexico. He says that means fields going dry in places like California's Imperial Valley and Yuma County, Arizona, and that will take a toll on those regional economies.
This is scary stuff. You know, we need to recognize that it's not just a math problem that can be solved by engineering. We need to recognize the human toll that this takes on communities.
The threat of these cuts has been looming for years, says Ann Castle, who worked on water policy in the Obama administration. She says reducing water use would have been easier to pull off gradually.
But it's very difficult to proactively agree to take less water when there's not a crisis.
She says that crisis point is where we find ourselves now. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
I got good news and I got bad news about gas prices. The good news is the AAA says the national average price for a gallon is down. Bad news that it's down just a penny and a half, $4.94 a gallon today. And that goes a real long way to explaining all the White House attention on gas prices and to President Biden saying this yesterday.
To the companies running gas stations and setting those prices at the pump, this is a time of war, global peril, Ukraine. These are not normal times. Bring down the price you are charging at the pump to reflect the cost you are paying for the product.
So does it really work like that? Marketplace's Kristen Schwab talks prices and the pump.
For starters, that Shell or Mobil gas station you drive by isn't actually owned by Shell or Mobil. They're not even franchises. They're owned by individuals who pay oil companies to use their name. Jeff Leonard is with the National Association of Convenience Stores.
It's a one-store operator that has a brand of liquid that that person sells.
And these business owners are the ones who set the price you see when you drive by. Lots of power for a local entrepreneur, sort of, not exactly.
There's really not much that a retailer can do to move the price of gas.
He says gas station owners set prices based on what they'll pay for their next shipment. Deliveries happen anywhere from multiple times a day to every 3 days, depending on the station. Then the owners add a markup of about 30 cents a gallon. After operating costs, Leonard says the average gas station makes about 10 cents per gallon in profits.
Fuel's a traffic driver. It gets people to the pump.
It's often said that they make more money selling coffee than they do gasoline.
Dean Foreman is an economist at the American Petroleum Institute. He says gas stations are really retailers, selling you a soda, a lottery ticket, or a car wash. For some businesses, gas actually loses money. Think chain grocery stores and warehouse clubs that might sell gas at a lower price than their competitors.
The more things you sell, the less important gasoline is to your viability as a business.
The sellers who might have a little wiggle room to make extra money are stations in rural areas or right off highways. Hugh Daigle, a professor of petroleum engineering at the University of Texas at Austin, says these owners face less competition, so they can up the price. But it's not all going into their pockets.
Because the distribution and transportation costs, might be quite expensive.
He says ultimately, what's really driving the cost of gas is the price of oil and our limited capacity right now to refine it. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
There's a new paper out from the Center for Economic Policy Research and some others about Brexit and the British economy and how that has worked out for them a couple of years on now from actual departure. Not great is the layman's answer. Worse for trade, worse for financials, worse for immigration, just worse. Not everything, though, that ails the British economy is Brexit in nature. The UK is in the middle of the biggest national rail strike over there in 30 years. Others, bus drivers and garbage collectors among them, have walked out too. Teachers and even some government-funded lawyers are said to be thinking about it. The proximate cause? Inflation in the UK, sitting at 9.1%, there as here the highest it's been in 40 years. We all know the reasons why in both places, but as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now from London, British workers are taking it out on the government.
In a protest organised by the labour unions, thousands of people marched through London last weekend calling for further action against the cost of living crisis.
The way that the prices, the gas, electricity, astronomical, absolutely ridiculous, and they've got to do something about it.
Protester Barry Todman. While inflation's running at 9%, wages are growing at less than half that rate, a recipe for disaster, says another protester, Philip Brand.
There's a real concern come the autumn that there will be civil unrest because people cannot make ends meet, even though they're working.
He's a mental health nurse, earning, he says, an average salary, and yet he claims that he's even had to do without heating during cold weather. Alexandria Hassett, also taking part in the protest, has been hit harder by the soaring prices of energy and food. Unemployed, she's having a much tougher time scraping by on welfare of $150 a week.
How is it affecting your life? You're not
like
skipping
saying,
meals. You're not doing without food.
I am skipping meals. I won't be eating until Monday when I get paid next.
It's now Saturday morning.
Yeah.
You're not going to eat until Monday.
No, the money's just not lasting me.
In a BBC survey, more than half the respondents said they'd bought less food or skipped meals to save money. Many, like 76-year-old widow Yvonne de Burgo, have cut back drastically on their social life as well.
I just don't have spare money to go out and have coffee with my girlfriends and have a laugh and a joke. And it's just making me so isolated.
She's angry the state pension on which she depends is going up by only 3%, while the Bank of England's forecasting 11% inflation by the fall.
They have no perception of what it's like to live on a fixed income with prices going up. Where are you supposed to get the extra money from?
The Chancellor of the Exchequer.
Where else? And here was Britain's finance chief, Chancellor Rishi Sunak, in Parliament doling out some extra money.
No government can solve every problem, but this government will never stop trying to help people.
Sunak has tried to soften the cost of living crisis with a $45 billion package of cash payments and energy bill subsidies. And he's now said that next year the state pension will rise to match the double-digit inflation expected in the fall. But some economists, like Andrew Hilton of the CSFI think tank in London, say all this extra cash will only make matters worse.
He's pumping money in to try and hold prices down, which makes no sense whatsoever economically.
Even more money chasing too few goods, the classic definition of inflation. On the other hand, says Paul Dales of Capital Economics, with the biggest fall in British living standards since the austere 1950s in the cards, the government had to act.
To help support households' incomes, which is important and necessary, and especially as it has been tilted towards the lower income households who need it most.
But the government's package won't fully offset the cut in purchasing power due to inflation. Certainly the protesters who marched through London at the weekend were unimpressed. Most of them public sector workers. They demanded that their pay keep up with the 9% inflation. Paul Johnson of the Institute of Fiscal Studies fears a wage price spiral.
But if all groups of workers manage to get big pay rises, then that's bad news for all of us, because that embeds inflation in the economy.
In a traditional display of worker solidarity, a brass band accompanied the protesters at the weekend. The march sounded reminiscent of the 1970s and the so-called Winter of Discontent, a massive upsurge of labour unrest also triggered originally by inflation. The unions are much weaker now, but some fear history could repeat itself, and that a summer of discontent is on the way. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today. I mentioned a couple of days ago how rents really have gotten too damn high. Single-family rents up 14% in April from a year ago. Well, get this. Saw this in the New York Times today. Data from a real estate consulting firm out here in California that says having a mortgage on a house costs $839 more per month than having a lease does. A year ago, the spread between owning and renting basically flat. Rising interest rates, high home prices. I mean, the math kind of makes sense. Okay, we're done. Here is your moment of economic context. Maybe the last time I track this one regularly, which is the way we used to handle it back in the before times. First time claims for unemployment benefits came out this morning because it's Thursday and that's the way the government does it. 229,000 people filed first time claims last week, well back into the normal range for that particular indicator. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.